The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and thanks for coming to FT.com. I'm Cardiff Garcia, a New York-based writer for FT Alphaville, and I'm joined today by Jan Hatzius, chief U.S. economist of Goldman Sachs, and he's here to talk to us about his outlook for next year, the state of fiscal and monetary policy, and a few other things besides. So we've got a lot to cover, but I want to start with fiscal policy, right? So at the time of this taping, Congress has yet to figure out what it's going to do about extending the payroll tax cut, Medicare doc fix, and unemployment benefits. And in your outlook for next year, you've got growth already slowing from about 3% annualized now in the fourth quarter to roughly 1% in the first half of the year. And that assumed that the payroll tax cut would get extended. So talk about the importance of these fiscal measures to the economy earlier next year.
So the baseline that's currently built in is indeed that the payroll tax cut gets extended, but the unemployment benefits lapse. Those are the two most important parts of what needs to be discussed and what just failed, I guess, on fiscal policy. If the payroll tax cut were to lapse as well, that would mean some additional downside. It's about $110 billion of disposable income, depending on what kind of multiplier you want to assume. That could certainly take off another half percentage point or more from growth. So I think that would be a pretty significant risk on the downside. Our assumption, though, is that probably the payroll tax cut will get extended, and there's a very good chance, I think, still that the unemployment benefits are going to be extended as well. If both of those get extended, then you have a little bit of upside. You know, I don't think that that we're looking at zero growth. I don't think we're looking at a recession. I do think that growth is going to be a little slower in the first half of the year, and fiscal policy is part of that.
Okay. You had a note out last week discussing the U.S. economy's exposure to Europe, and you said in that note that you expect what's happening overseas to shave about 1 percentage point off GDP growth next year, with a big chunk of that coming through banking spillover. So tell us what you meant and how bad you think it's going to be.
So I'd say there are, broadly speaking, three channels through which what's happening in Europe is going to affect the U.S. The first, the most obvious one, is reduced exports to the euro area. That's quite small. The U.S. only exports about 2% of its GDP to the euro area. So you would need to see some very large declines in imports, much larger than what I think is plausible, to get a really big effect from that. The second is tightening of financial conditions, lower stock prices, stronger dollar. That, you know, has kind of gone on and off a little bit because markets, of course, have been quite volatile. Right now, we'd say that might take off a quarter to a half point from GDP growth. So through that channel. And then the last one is the banking channel and the linkages between the banking system of Europe and the banking system of the U.S. And again, there are a couple of different channels there, but the one that we focused on in some of our recent research is the holdings of U.S. assets by euro area banks and the pressure to deleverage on the European banking system. And the numbers that we came up with under assumptions that seem, perhaps a bit more negative than the baseline, but not implausible, is sort of 3 or 4 tenths off of GDP growth through that particular channel. So that's something that is probably going to have more of an impact in the first half of next year than it has had so far.
Okay, let's switch to monetary policy for a second. So the Fed didn't do anything last week, but it wasn't expected to. But there's been a lot of talk about what it might do either at the January meeting or at least in the first quarter, first half of next year. So one is more clarity in its communication strategy, possibly publishing its forecast for the federal funds rate, maybe another round of QE, including a big part of that being MBS purchases.
Right.
And I think they're even considering now possibly a more explicit target for inflation and maybe even for unemployment. What do you think the Fed should do in the first part of next year that's within the realm of the possible?
So I'll tell you what our forecast is, and then I'll talk a little bit about what what we think they could do in addition to that. As far as forecast is concerned, we expect a lot of the things you just mentioned. We do expect a path for the federal funds rate, or rather a collection of paths, because it probably will represent the views of the different FOMC participants. It's not going to be one path that will be decided by the committee. But we think that probably happens at the January FOMC meeting. We think an inflation target, which is a small step really going from what they're saying now, the mandate consistent rate of inflation, to saying the inflation target. We think that probably also happens at the January FOMC meeting. And we do expect some additional QE, probably largely through mortgages, though probably not yet at the January meeting. That we think doesn't happen until later in the first half, maybe closer to the middle of the year.
Right.
In terms of what they should do, or what they could do if they wanted to produce additional stimulus and help the economy get back to full employment more quickly, one thing that we've suggested, and that we think has some very desirable properties, is a nominal GDP target. We continue to be far below the pre-crisis trend of nominal GDP. We haven't really made up any of the gap that opened up, this unprecedented gap really in the data of the last few decades at least, this unprecedented gap that opened up in 2007, 2008. We haven't made up any of it. And that we think that if the FOMC adopted a nominal GDP level target, that could get you back to the dual mandate inflation and unemployment more quickly than the policy they're pursuing now. We don't expect that as our forecast. We don't think that they are about to move to a nominal GDP target. So there's a bit of a difference here between what we think might be a sensible option and what they're actually likely to do in the foreseeable future.
Okay, let's talk a little more though about nominal GDP targeting, because it was your endorsement of the idea in October that really rejuvenated the debate over the merits of the idea. We could probably talk about this for a very long time, but we don't have time to do that. So let me just throw a couple of the more common objections to the idea at you and get your reaction
sure.
to that. One is that to get the NGDP level back to its trend, its pre-crisis trend, would require a period of catch-up inflation. And I think what a lot of people worry about is that the Fed can't engineer the right kind of inflation, that because there's so much slack in labor markets, you won't end up with the kind of virtuous wage inflation that you'd hope for. Instead, you might end up with higher food and gas prices, maybe because investors would react to something like this and they'd push up commodities prices, because that's a market where resources are very much constrained. So can you address that objection first?
So what it requires is a period of stronger nominal GDP growth. It doesn't necessarily require a period of higher inflation. I mean, it's certainly possible that most of this, in fact, I think it's likely in our simulations of what a nominal GDP target that's sort of enforced via additional quantitative easing, what that might look like. Our simulations would suggest most of it actually comes through the real side rather than through the inflation side. So I don't think it's entirely clear that you would get significantly higher inflation. The other point is that, of course, we have a lot of slack at the moment. So the baseline, what would happen in the absence of a shift to a nominal GDP target, is probably declining inflation. At least that's what I think is likely. So you would, relative to that baseline, you might see higher inflation, but in absolute terms, might not actually be that high. Now, if you did get somewhat higher inflation, then we would say that's part of the story. There is, of course, some risk. It's rare that you get a potentially significant reward without any risk. I do think there's some risk that you could see instability in long-term inflation expectations. I think that's true with most ways of making monetary policy more accommodative than it is now. If you try to be much more aggressive, then there will be some risk to longer-term inflation expectations. I would say one thing for nominal GDP targeting compared with other options, though, which is that there's a natural exit strategy for a nominal GDP level target that you wouldn't have, for example, with a simple increase in the inflation target. If you just said we're increasing the inflation target to, you know, 4% or 5%, it wouldn't really be obvious at what point that temporary period of higher inflation should end. So I think the risk of unmooring long-term inflation expectations would be pretty large in that case. But with a nominal GDP target, it'd be pretty clear. You want to get back to the pre-crisis trend. Once you're at the pre-crisis trend, you will need to see a tightening of policy. And at that point, the markets should also expect that the extra accommodation would be pared back.
You know, when you look back at what happened with QE2, right, one interpretation of it is that at a time when deflation really was threatening, it raised inflation expectations, asset prices climbed again. For a little while, it seemed like the economy was doing better. But once the signaling mechanism wore off and the Fed, again, could no longer credibly commit to continuing on with easing for as long as it would take to reduce unemployment meaningfully or, keep the economy going, the effect wore off, too. And that's, I think, what led a lot of people to conclude that monetary policy was effectively constrained in what it could do. And this, again, ties back into the issue with NGDP targeting. So I take it you would dispute that interpretation of events.
I would say, the question is basically what is the baseline of what the economy would have done in the absence of QE. And, of course, nobody knows the answer to that. So that's why it's something that, you can debate for a long time. When I look broadly at the evidence that we've accumulated over the last few years in particular, in terms of what central banks can do once they hit the zero bound on nominal rates, I'm persuaded by the idea that they can still have an effect through purchases of assets, through reductions in the term premium, and that the easing of financial conditions that took place around QE2, that also led to somewhat stronger growth than you would have had in the absence of it. How much? Maybe half a percentage point. So we're not talking a massive impact here. Certainly nothing like QE1, where the effect, in my view, was much, much bigger. But that was also in an environment in which markets were much more dysfunctional and in which, therefore, a central bank that basically commits to putting a floor under financial conditions can also have a bigger impact.
Okay, let's turn to the housing market. You said that you think that the decline in home prices is set to end at some point next year, despite the sort of backlog in shadow inventory and just excess supply generally. Can you tell us why?
The reason why we think that we're close to the end of the downturn in housing is that we think the imbalance, the overvaluation of housing, the bubble, is behind us. When we look at the equilibrium home price over time, in our model that basically depends on things like population, income, construction costs, costs of capital, things that don't move very quickly. We had a very large overvaluation of over 30% at the peak. We have unwound that, and currently we're pretty close to fair value. Now there is still a lot of excess supply that is a short-term negative. That's why we think we'll probably see some further declines, 2 to 3%, in 2012, and we will end up significantly below the sort of equilibrium level. But our model basically says it ends sometime in 2012, and then 2013 is sort of a flattish year. And then you start seeing home price increases after that.
So not a quick bounce back.
Not a quick bounce back. And, the timing and the sort of quarter-to-quarter moves here are, of course, quite uncertain. But we do think we're reasonably close to the end.
So we actually had some housing start numbers this morning, and the single-family numbers were, as bad as they usually are. But it seems like multifamily is starting to become one of the really legitimate bright spots in the U.S. economy. Is that something that you expect to continue?
Yes, because the multifamily market is much closer to normal supply levels. There's probably still some excess supply in aggregate, but there are many regional multifamily markets and rental markets where that's not the case, where supply is actually quite tight, and that is requiring some further increases in building. In the single-family sector, you know, we do seem to be getting a bottoming. We think we'll probably see some increases in single-family housing starts, but it's still going to be several years, probably middle of the decade, until we've actually unwound all of the excess supply in that market. That's at least our baseline assumption.
Okay. How far along is the consumer in the deleveraging cycle, and to what extent does it matter, you think?
I mean, deleveraging in terms of the level of debt or the debt to income ratio, we think there's probably still further to go. It depends a lot on which measure you look at. So as far as debt to income ratios go, we think there's still a further decline that will be necessary. We think that the pace of that decline is probably going to be a little slower than it has been in the past couple of years. Which means that the saving rate doesn't necessarily need to rise a lot from the sort of 3-5% range that we've been in recently. I'm somewhat distrustful on statistical grounds of the drop in the saving rate that occurred over the last few months. There's still a lot of revisions that have yet to come in those data. But broadly speaking, we'd say saving rate stays in that range, 3-5%. So at higher levels than what you had at the peak of the bubble, but in terms of the flows of spending and income, we have seen the adjustment there.
Sure. Let's talk about exports for a minute. They're not a huge part of the U.S. economy, but I'm wondering to what extent a really meaningful recovery depends on a kind of reversal of the sort of trade and, I guess, capital flows trends that we've seen since the late 90s. And the extent to which a U.S. recovery is dependent on a more global rebalancing?
So I think that that would certainly help a lot still. We're still running a sizable current account deficit. It's only about half as large as it was at the peak in 2005, 2006, but it's still quite large. It's still over 3% of GDP, probably bigger than what you can sustain on a long-term basis. And so the flip side of that is going to be that over time you will need to see stronger export growth and a rebalancing, as you said, from the housing sector, from the consumer, and from more domestically oriented sectors towards export-oriented sectors, both in mainly in goods, but also tradable services. So that adjustment has not yet occurred. We've seen the drop in the domestically oriented sector, certainly in housing with a vengeance. But in terms of where the recovery can come, I think a disproportionate part of that will need to be in the more externally oriented sectors.
Okay. And a lot's been made about how corporate profits have rebounded so strongly despite the general sluggishness of the recovery. And a lot of it's come from just productivity gains and cost cutting. And I'm wondering what you think needs to be done in order to get these companies to start investing more in capital and in hiring, and what your general outlook is for the corporate sector.
So my explanation for why profits have generally done well is primarily that we've gotten some growth. It hasn't been great. It's been pretty sluggish. But it's come in an environment in which the excess supply of labor is still very large. And therefore, wage gains have been very weak. And unit labor costs, which is ultimately what's going to be the most important driver, unit labor costs essentially relative to price inflation, that's going to be your biggest driver of corporate profit margins. Unit labor costs have been pretty much flat. So you've seen margin expansion. We think that there probably will be a little more of that, but at a reduced pace relative to where we've been over the past couple of years. On the investment side, I'd say we're seeing some recovery in investment, but it's a relatively slow move, and the reason is that it's not just profit margins that matter for that, but it's also utilization. Utilization continues to be quite low. Certainly on a whole economy basis, there's a lot of excess capacity still in the economy, and that's also weighing on investment.
Okay.
Given what we're seeing in utilization, what we're seeing in profit margins, we don't really think that there's a huge puzzle there in terms of where investment is. We've seen a recovery, but a muted one because of the excess capacity.
Okay. I want to ask a more epistemological question, I guess. You know, this is a time when a lot of research houses, investment banks put out their forecasts for the year, of course.
Right.
And I guess what I want to ask is how you think your clients and the public at large should use your research, given that policy plays such an important role in economic outcomes now, and that's very difficult to predict, and just the potential that a lot of these forecasts are going to be wrong.
Well, that's the world we live in. You know, trying to predict the future, unfortunately, means that some of the time your forecasts are wrong. The best way to use forecasts is to basically look at the analysis and see whether you can benefit from the analysis on which the forecast is based. And if you do agree with a lot of the analysis, and maybe you can incorporate some of it into your own thinking, then perhaps that's also going to be a more positive statement about the forecast itself. But I think it's also important to be explicit about what the forecast is based on, what the errors around forecasts are, I think it's useful to sort of quantify some of the relationships that go into the forecast. For example, the spillover from Europe, how large is it going to be for the U.S., the impact of fiscal policy. We try to put that together in figuring out our own forecast, but if we are explicit about the ways that these things hang together, then our readers and our clients are able to also take pieces of our analysis without necessarily endorsing or taking over essentially the entire overall view.
Okay. Last question. As we've seen with the NGDP debate, some of your research has obviously had a pretty big impact on the policy debate. Any thoughts of your own on ever leaving the private sector and joining the policy side and trying to influence things more directly?
I love being part of the policy debate. I think any economist is who's interested in macroeconomics is also going to be interested in debating monetary policy, fiscal policy, and things like that. I certainly am very interested in continuing that debate. Where that's going to be, I don't know. I'm at Goldman Sachs. I love what I do, but we'll see what happens in the future.
All right. Jan Hatzius, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.